Hello, this is Phyllis Furumoto with Reiki, Balancing Form and Essence. Well, we're here today to continue our discussion of teaching in different countries and how that is for masters. Each country that I've gone to has given me gifts, and also within those gifts, and sometimes the same things, are also challenges. And these come from my being an American and going into another country and sometimes assuming that the culture is the same because our language is the same, but of course I found that was not true. And also that because there are differences in the language, that a lot of the culture isn't true, and that there will be lots of differences in the culture, which I found quite interesting. For instance, when I went to Russia the first time, I was a bit freaked out about being in Russia, our enemy in the Cold War, and I found out very quickly that of all the countries that I've traveled to, Russia is the most similar to the United States that I have found. The depth and breadth of the population, the different nationalities all mixed together, the way that they are with each other and so on, that just seemed very similar. So that was interesting. And there were some differences, like the way that they handle money, which is still in a much different way, which I really like, actually. So I've found some masters who are still traveling and teaching, because a lot of the masters now, of course, stay at home and teach in their own local community, which is great. I think this is a kind of movement for Reiki and for masters in general, that instead of masters going around to all these different areas in the world, teaching for a while and then leaving, the master is staying in a local area and building up a Reiki community and staying there to provide some stability for the community, which I always felt like was the way that it was in Japan in the early days. Alima Fontaine, who's on our show today, lives in Mexico, in Cuernavaca, which is quite close to Mexico City. And she has had the good fortune to teach in the United States, so I thought it would be interesting to get her viewpoint of the United States and American classes through the eyes of someone who isn't really a native American, which is great. Alima, thank you for being on the show, and welcome.
Thank you, Phyllis. It's wonderful to be here.
So, Alima, we're going to start out, of course, with a little bit of your background, of how you met Reiki, and about your teaching experience. Like, in general, what has teaching brought to you?
Yes. I kept thinking that the fact that I was born in Mexico and my parents are French seemed to be already something that would come into my Reiki teaching many years later. And living in Mexico. I came to Reiki 20 years ago, and as you mentioned, my master was traveling to Mexico and came to teach here. And it was for me a completely transforming experience. It felt like, interestingly enough, I had been looking for a way to feel that I belonged. And I think for all my life. And when I had that experience with the first degree, it felt like I had come home and that I could stop looking for a home. It was an immense relief. And immense, and really, like feeling that I have found my family. And it's not because my family and I don't get along. It's just that I felt more a family on a very, on a larger, much larger way or sense. And it was always you know, waiting for my master to come back to Mexico.
Uh-huh.
So we could meet and we could have conversations and I could participate, you know, as a witness to her classes and organize for her. So it's a very wonderful perspective that you're bringing to this subject.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of building community, I think it's a very thank you. It gives me a very wonderful image about it.
Mm-hmm.
I started teaching 10 years ago when I was in Ish.
I'm sorry. Yes. I'm gonna interrupt you a minute.
Yes.
Because I want to go back to this place of being a student, and you were a student for many years before you became a master. Is that true?
Yes, 10 years.
10 years. So in that 10 years, did you ever think that you would have liked for Upasana to have lived in Mexico and been available, or did you feel supported in some way? And this is not about Upasana personally, but just about this phenomena of masters traveling and coming back and travel, you know, going away and coming back.
Well, it's a wonderful question. I was initiated, and then Upasana came to live to Mexico for about four years.
Uh-huh.
So the time she wasn't there, I missed her.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't, we were in contact, it wasn't a lack of contact, it was just the fact that I really liked the places that we went to when we spoke of our practice, or
mm-hmm.
we exchanged Reiki treatments or got together with groups that wanted to, you know, to have Reiki gatherings around her.
Mm-hmm.
And it is true that it is something that I missed. And then when she was in Mexico, my practice deepened.
Mm-hmm.
Because she had, we shared much more time together, and I remember she traveled to the conferences, for example, and then when she came back, she was so full with, you know, her impressions and experiences that it gave me, that's when I began knowing that I wanted not only to become a Reiki master, but belong to the community.
Uh-huh.
For example. Mm. Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Yes.
That's beautiful. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And so when you were initiated as a master, you began to teach in Mexico?
Yes.
Around your own home community?
Yes, yes. I
uh-huh.
basically taught in Mexico City and Cuernavaca.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
I was initiated, I still live in another town called Toluca, and I was initiated there and had my first groups there. And those students, unfortunately, I have not been able to continue to have a close contact with.
Uh-huh.
It's interesting that by coming to Cuernavaca, which is not far away, it's about 2.5 hours, many of the emails have changed. I don't get responses when I write, but I do from the students that I have initiated in Mexico City and here.
Uh-huh.
We have very close conversations.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not with all my students, but many,
mm-hmm.
many.
And mm-hmm.
have, so yes, it's a very profound perspective that, you know, this brings for me at least, you know, as I'm traveling and I'm going to the U.S. and have more Reiki students in California right now than I have, well, it's the place that I'm teaching now that is not in Mexico.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Mm-hmm. So how did you get to California?
During one of Paul's retreats, I met Linda O'Hanlon, and she's one of Elizabeth Warnhold's students.
Ah.
And we really liked each other. I mean, we started conversations, and I lived in California for many years, so that felt like it was closer to home
uh-huh.
than, you know, than perhaps other places in the U.S.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Yes. So we started conversations, and then at some point we began talking about the possibility of me going to L.A. to teach Reiki. And at that time, Elizabeth didn't want to travel to L.A. anymore
uh-huh.
because she had been teaching in L.A. So we spoke with her, and she was very open about, you know, about me going back to L.A. and going back to Linda, who had organized her workshops for her.
Uh-huh. Beautifully done. Mm-hmm. Wonderful.
Yes.
So you sort of took over the mentorship, did you, of her community there?
Of some of her students, yes.
Yeah, that's great.
Yes.
Which is a wonderful way for masters to create a community that for themselves in the same way as students do, that, I don't know, I guess the premise is not about possession, that these are my students, but about supporting the students in their practice of Reiki, however yeah. that needs to be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, beautiful.
Yes. And it has opened the way for Elizabeth and I to have wonderful conversations about it.
Oh, great.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. And it's been, you know, it's been really wonderful to experience. I had not had the experience of teaching in another culture, and how different it feels.
Well, and I have to say that for myself, when I teach in California, it's like a different culture.
Really?
Than other places in the United States.
Oh, well, that's fascinating.
Yeah,
too.
It is. So I'll be interested to hear what you have to say.
Yes. Well, I was when I was treating myself this morning and thinking about this subject, I was realizing that one of the aspect that has that draws, or where the conversations really seem to focus in, is on the spiritual practice.
Uh-huh.
When I'm teaching in LA.
Oh, interesting.
Yes. When I teach a class in Mexico, it has the relationship with each person's spiritual practice is something that seems very easy and open. You know, when I teach in Mexico about healing energy and universal life energy and God energy, you know, it seems like the word God comes by itself.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's like I say universal life energy, and then they respond saying to me, so it's God's energy.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's something that just seems to be very open and fluid, and we don't even stop there.
Uh-huh. You know, and
this is in Mexico. Uh-huh. And then this is my experience when I go and teach in California. And then as soon as I say universal life energy, is what does that mean?
Uh-huh. Okay, so what does that mean, Alima?
Exactly. It took me a moment to sort of wonder what the question is about.
Uh-huh.
So I ask, you know, I don't understand the question, because what would you like me to say? And then we start talking about different religious or spiritual practices.
Uh-huh.
And where does Reiki fit into all of this?
Uh-huh.
There seems to be sort of a stricter belief system. And when I teach, and maybe it's my teaching, it's because I come from Mexico, my teaching reflects something that opens ways for discussion.
Oh,
so
interesting.
It's been really interesting to see, I've had students that are Mormons and other students that belong to different churches and students that belong, you know, that have their own spiritual practice.
Uh-huh.
And that, to teach the Reiki, the first degree was always about, well, how does this fit into my personal practice? I was very, very impressed, you know, with it. It really brought a different depth to my understanding of teaching.
Ah, how is that so?
Because, I guess for me, my Reiki was always my spiritual practice. You know, it didn't make noise in terms of, is this going to be in conflict with another religious practice, for example, because I didn't have one.
Uh-huh.
So, it became my practice. And when I began, speaking with people who had a very, how would I say this? I can almost, perhaps it's not the word, but mental idea of a spiritual practice, all these ideas and things that had to be accommodated within the spiritual practice or spiritual aspect of our practice. It gave me a way to understand that I had to deepen my understanding of religiousness, for example, and religious practice, and find words that were words that perhaps didn't cause a conflict of interest.
So, any examples?
For example, yes, I have one. A student who says, well, you know, in my practice, a Mormon practice, women cannot heal.
Oh, interesting.
So, yes. So we had fascinating discussions about what could she do, you know, with her Reiki practice. If she had to reevaluate that teaching, that belief.
And what did you come to?
Well, we had I can say sometimes like strong discussions,
right?
You know, because it built up, and with some time passed, and I traveled a year later. And she had found a way first to practice on herself for almost a whole year.
Wow.
And then somebody had gotten ill in her family, and she could not help, you know, saying, I would really like to place my hands on you and let's see what happens. So she started by treating a family member and by witnessing what happened with that process. And
wow.
Her building her own understanding of how Reiki could heal through her.
And how did she resolve the teaching and her Reiki practice? Do you know?
Well because she still practices and she keeps this understanding privately. She doesn't share this understanding or her practice with her religious group.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because it brings to mind a little comment that my grandmother made one time, which I found fascinating. She had gone to India. When was it? The early 1950s, I think. And she was a guest of someone, and she was traveling with this person in order to give this person Reiki treatments along the way. And when she went to India, she was asked if she would teach there. And she said, no, not until your culture changes. Because she realized very quickly that there were all these different structures about, you know, between men and women, and how men, you know, that some people could touch other people and other people couldn't touch other people. And then there were the untouchables who nobody could touch, men or women. And there was this whole structure of, you know, physical contact that was, I assume, the part of her process. And now, of course, there's lots of Reiki being taught in India. And it's interesting because that whole structure is also breaking down. Because it's becoming much more westernized. So it's interesting to see how that will go for her. And I appreciate the student's willingness to make a space for her to hold this paradox for herself,
yes,
until she finds a way to understand how two practices can be valid and yet seemingly have opposite viewpoints on certain things.
Yes.
And this is very mature. There are not a lot of people who can grasp that right in the moment. They have to have some time to think about it.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
I mean, that's very brave of her.
Very, very brave. I could sense the internal conflict this was bringing.
Uh-huh.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, and you know, I really appreciate the Reiki group that is growing in LA, and really because that's where I'm teaching, and seeing how you know, how the culture seems to be so, as you say, so specific to the state. You know, I have, for example, Reiki students that are in the world of cinema and acting and see really a very genuine call to find what I think I found when I got my first degree, which is this sense of belonging,
mm-hmm.
To a spiritual and healing practice. But I can see there is a great call for spiritual space.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
That not necessarily involves having a religious space.
Right. Well, what does that mean for you?
Well, for me, it's been sort of my questions this past year. Is how can I create a place for a paradox to be held, and as peacefully as possible, mm-hmm. inside of me,
uh-huh.
you know, because I was raised somehow against religion, which is something very cultural, I think, in my family, and I was, now that I see and I have a possibility of seeing how I don't know if it's two spiritual spaces or practices can be held together and can actually live together.
Mm-hmm.
Is something very beautiful for me.
Uh-huh.
Because I want to be able inside of me to hold the space for anything that is that creates a spiritual experience,
mm-hmm.
for me and my students.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for Mexico is filled with a relationship with magic.
Yeah.
So many of my students have very, very committed spiritual lives.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in the previous years of my teaching, I couldn't internally hold together both. For me, it was Reiki.
Uh-huh.
And I couldn't really open to listen to very, very deep spiritual experiences on
mm-hmm.
the part of my students.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that I now hold, and I think it really is in part thanks to this first group I had the privilege to share Reiki with in LA.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. So when you talk about the spirituality of Mexico, which I feel is so vibrant, is the word that I would use.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some spirituality, you just have a sense of perhaps an inner calmness or something. And in Mexico, it just mm-hmm. seems like vibrant is the word, in every sense of the word. It like vibrates out of the colors that are used and the way the churches are decorated and the wonderful flowers, whether they're made out of material or they're real flowers. They're just bright and that, you know, for me is about spirit. And then there is this other interesting flavor to this vibrancy, which is this great acknowledgement of magic that they don't need to know why. I think as Americans, we tend to want to analyze and figure out why this is happening. You know, if there's a phenomena that happens, something that happens within our Reiki practice, then, you know, everybody says, well, why did that happen? And why didn't it happen the last time I did this? And why will it always happen now? And that's not so prevalent, I think, in Mexico. Do you think that's true?
Absolutely. And you're saying that, and I smile because I see this. I was wondering and looking for the word. You know, it was the first thing that came is this childlike knowing, because it's a knowing. It's not infantile. It's this sort of innocent place where everything is possible.
Mm-hmm.
And I can see, I was remembering a conversation yesterday of a woman who is helping me get my knee back in shape. And she had an accident and couldn't read for 10 years because she fell and had a very strong blow on her head. And her way of telling how significant this is and how this is, you know, this is a divine gift asks no questions.
Mm.
There is no why did it happen to me, or, you know, there is absolutely not that. This is a gift. I'm just going to find it.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right, in that's exactly what I feel during the Reiki classes. You know, there is no question. You know, they do not, my students, I can feel them. They just take it as another of one of divine gifts.
Mm-hmm.
And the way they bring it together and they integrate it in their lives is really beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Really beautiful. And there's the other part of this experience, and it's perhaps when bad things happen, then, you know, somebody's doing magic on me.
Right.
Or you know, there's also this way of perhaps not taking responsibility or wanting to look deeper into things because it might be something that is the other side of magic.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
there's a lot of both sides.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I think makes it vibrant.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what do you feel like is the definition is not the word I want, but what does it mean when you say magic? Does it mean just these inexplicable things that happen through Reiki, or as you said, this woman having an accident and then having this experience of not being able to read and then somehow regaining that ability? I mean, I'm just wondering what magic means to the Mexicans, because it's a very loaded word culturally.
Yes, yes. Well, I think it's very structured. It's not this weird thing that happens. It's actually something that is, I can hear it when people say, you know, she's ill, and then somebody understanding that as, yes, it's because somebody said something yesterday, or because there's a wind that got into her body, or there's a whole structure and knowledge that has been passed on that is in the world of magic. It's not miracles.
No?
No. It's part of this unspoken understanding of how I understand events.
Uh-huh.
It's really, really, and this is something that for me is culturally different. I wasn't raised like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it is definitely something you go and see somebody who works with magic when you want to change your life. And then you have specific instructions, and, you know, herbs you have to shower with or drink, or, and then you have to do a whole series of things. There's something very structured behind it.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that your Reiki students see Reiki as this magic, which is that you're giving them a structure to change their lives?
Exactly.
Really?
I do think that they get this sense that they are vehicles of wonderful magical happenings in their lives and the lives of others.
Uh-huh.
And it all comes from God,
uh-huh.
You know, or their understanding of it. There's no struggle.
Mm. Beautiful. So what about, so then you said, but these are not miracles. So what's the difference between magic and miracle.
That becomes more religious.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. The miracles of, you know, it's more within what I hear is the Catholic understanding of miracles.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Which is the...
You know, like the seeing some religious image on a rock or something, or something that it's actually, as you say, it's a very good question, because when you say es un milagro, it's something that happened by itself, not without the intervention of other human beings.
Well, I just think, the energy of miracle, because I've lived in the Southwest a lot, the energy of miracle within the Hispanic culture is just totally prevalent. And it got me to thinking about miracles way before I got into Reiki. And, it was this wonderful possibility that my life could just change without any human intervention.
Yes.
And that possibility was not hope, but it was more than hope. It was just an understanding that I could hold as I lived my life in my kind of everyday drudgery kind of place. I don't know if they believe that their lives are drudgery, but at that point I did. that was really neat for me to be able to connect with that energy and have this kind of, you know, aliveness to what might happen.
Yes, yes, and exactly, which is this place of openness and, you know, in awe. That there is a greater power,
mm-hmm.
and anything is possible.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Yeah.
So, do you feel that that this place of you that came home, you know, found a home, is that universal in your classes? Not meaning that everybody has this experience, but that no matter where you teach, there are people who have the same experience.
Yes, I do.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, yes, and what I've come to realize, and it's beautiful, is that we each have our own home. The sense feels universal, and when I speak with my students and they say, you know, I have a feeling I've come home, I wonder and I ask, you know, could you tell me more about it?
Mm-hmm.
What does coming home mean to you? And then hear and listen how we each come home our own way. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've had that that spoken in my class over and over and over, and especially after the first or second initiation, you know, people just say, well, you know, I feel like I've come home. And, you know, it's so interesting that we as human beings now on the planet are somehow searching for this feeling of home without even knowing that we're searching for it.
Yes.
Yeah. I don't know. Was that conscious for you?
Oh, no. It was the sense for me at that time was an incredible relief. And I now see that I was really looking for my spiritual home. That really was, I was asking and asking and asking questions about the meaning of life and death. And that's where I finally, you know, it seemed like the question just dissolved. It didn't matter anymore. And that was home for me.
So, you know, one of the things that I really love in teaching in all these different countries is that this is one of the very powerful similarities that happen. And I always, in the beginning, I had a wondering about what would be that there were all these differences on the surface, then what would be the similarities underlying, you know, all of these different cultures? And the search for home, the search for a spiritual anchor, or I don't know if anchor is quite the right word, but connection, maybe, is very universal and doesn't seem to matter what the prevalent religion is or religious experience or the culturally prevalent ideas about spirit and so on.
Yes.
It's all the same.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, it's fascinating.
Hmm.
So, when you have your groups, either in LA or in Mexico, do you speak about this?
Yes, I do. You know, when I tell a little bit my story, I mentioned that I felt like I didn't need to search anymore. And it is something that I, and it's interesting because it's something that perhaps is not right away something they get.
Mm-hmm.
But when we get together, and then we practice again together, then they say, oh, this is the same sense. You know, it's this knowing.
Mm-hmm.
It's this feeling of knowing. And then we can get, you know, into very deep conversations and exchanges about their practice and mine. And it's, you know, I want to go back a little bit to what you were saying about traveling and students really and building community.
Mm-hmm.
That I feel is something that I've been wondering about as a master.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how to create a sense of community and release the need to own our students.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So they can find community within where they are.
Right.
You know,
right.
And I think that is something that I'm going to be keeping from this conversation and thinking about.
Uh-huh.
You know, about how to create a possibility for students to be, to come home.
Mm-hmm.
To a physical practice, you know, physical groups and conversations and exchanges, so that sense can be nourished.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, one of the things that's interesting for me is that there are some communities, and it doesn't seem to matter culturally where this is in the world, that just take to it and they immediately just bond together and they keep coming back and doing the practice. And then there are other communities where it seems like that's a real effort. And one of the things that I had in mind, or have had in mind for a while, but I don't know really how to do this, is I realized that in the martial arts, they have dojos where that is the center of their community. It's not really the master, it's the dojo.
Mm.
And the dojo comes along, of course, with the sensei, but also there's a kind of advanced student who takes over if the sensei is not there. And whether this is taekwondo or judo or aikido or whatever the martial art is, the impetus of the student and the understanding of the student is that they have to practice daily, weekly, you know, over a long period of time in order to get past the mechanics of the practice and into the deeper aspects of what they're really doing, which is really not, in some way it's self-defense, but it's not self-defense in the way that I think that I innocently in the beginning thought about it, which is to hurt someone else who is wanting to hurt you, but more to create the space where people won't even come to you to hurt you.
Yes.
You know, that's fascinating. And this is the same. I just have this feeling of wanting to somehow apply these principles to the Reiki practice, because it's exactly the same thing. I mean, on some level, some people do experience what I call milagros, miracles, where they treat themselves and their diabetes goes away, or they treat themselves and they don't have to wear glasses anymore, or they treat themselves and, you know, in a month and a half, their cancer disappears. You know, all these different, you know, kind of miracle stories. So that happens. But then there's this other part where it doesn't happen to some people, and then they go, well, like, what is Reiki doing for me? Mm-hmm. And I just think, well, you know, in all of these cases, both of these cases, there's a part of the practice which is also about longevity and about trying to build community. But I really get that it's not very, what should I say? It doesn't seem to be beneficial for Reiki communities to be centered around one person.
Yes.
But to be centered around a place that holds the energy of the practice. And this is a part of this shift that I would really like to make, but I don't know how to do it personally, and I'm just wondering if you have any ideas or have had any thoughts about that, because I know you also do teach dance and are a member of this dance group, and I feel that that's maybe similar to what I'm talking about with the dojos.
Yes, yes, I think it's a wonderful idea. And I can hear, now that you were talking about it, I can hear that many students and masters are saying, I really want to have a place.
Uh-huh.
You know, I really want to have a place, either a place that I will, you know, that I run, or I want to contribute to a place. But there is a very, very strong calling for community.
Uh-huh.
For coming together to practice.
Uh-huh.
And very, very much in Mexico.
Wow.
There is a house in Mexico City that is that has several Reiki masters from several lineages that want to have a house where we can teach and come together and practice and offer, you know, Reiki-related experiences.
Oh, that's
so
great.
It's called Casa Luna.
Ah.
And there's another woman that I will be visiting soon in Monterrey, and she's also thinking of, she's not a Reiki master, so she just wants to have a space so Reiki can be practiced. So I really think that you're probably voicing out what the community is also longing for.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And I love the idea that it would be the place rather than the individual.
Right. Right, because individuals then can pass through and offer their own gifts, but it's Reiki that's the center of attention, and this is for me what is important.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I wonder, you know, in my experience of teaching, for instance, in El Paso, the students there call me Master Phyllis, or Master Furumoto, or just Master, you know, the Master.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning, and it really, at the beginning, it was really difficult for me because I have my own sort of personal issue is really to be the same as everyone. Of course, I'm not. And not to be egotistical, but, you know, we're unique. And so, you know, my whole thing about being the same as, you know, my blonde-haired, blue-eyed neighbor who, you know, had a very different life as far as I was concerned than I did, because she was blonde-haired and blue-eyed, really irritated me that I couldn't ever be like her. And so this whole dynamic of wanting to be like somebody and yet knowing that I would never be that is maybe what you were talking about being lost.
Yes.
A little bit.
Yes.
And so I just had this experience of, you know, the same kind of paradox happening with these people who are calling me master and, you know, and acknowledging their studentship over and over and over.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some really beautiful acknowledgement, because in that, I assumed that they thought that I was better than them. But in fact, that's not actually true in my experience.
Yes.
And that's so hard as an American to get. Because, you know, we're, I don't know, in these vast generalizations that one can make, I believe that in the States, having a title is really important. And so we have all these weird titles, like for middle management, like the assistant to the associate director of so-and-so. It's like, oh my God. And, you know, all of these words mean something in salary and in status and so on. So, you know, with that kind of mentality, I went into this thing in El Paso with a lot of resistance. And now I just get that it was a gift that they were giving me that I wasn't accepting.
Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I, you know, I agree with you. Coming from the culture that I come from, the fact that I'm, you know, that they call me master, is something that I have a hard time receiving. Because it is a very simple way of honoring.
Uh-huh.
And you know, the downfall of it is that Mexico is really a culture about obedience. It's
uh-huh.
very easy to call somebody master. Actually, it's more of a confrontation to be on a one-to-one same level culturally.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And it is wonderful to, I think it's a wonderful process to receive the word master. For me, saying my students was, you know, it still is something that I use with consciousness. It's not something that I use very freely. But
uh-huh.
I see that Mexican masters refer to their students as my students.
Mm-hmm.
Without any, absolutely any thought.
Right.
It's normal. It's natural.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Well, I think that's true, your world around, because we have this kind of unconscious possessiveness of our students, which we've touched on, you know, over this course of this conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And in some places, that possessiveness gets very intense. So one of the things that I realized when I was in Mexico, and we were having these big events for, you know, 200 to 300 students, and many masters would like to bring their students, but say the master themselves had an engagement or somehow didn't want to come to the event, their students wouldn't come, even though they wanted to, because their master wasn't there.
Yes.
And that's very common in Mexico.
Yes, it is. It
uh-huh.
is. It is, because loyalty is very strong.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
So if my master isn't there, then, you know, that's as far as I can see. It's really, I think culture, I'm fascinated by cultures.
I have experienced that also. When you're the beneficiary of that loyalty, it can be very ego-boosting, for instance.
Yes.
But there's another part of the loyalty which, for me, if the master is not careful, will keep their students out of a kind of multicultural, if we can use this word again, multicultural Reiki experience, to having just a monoculture, which is just the way that they practice and just the way that they teach and just the way that their values are. And for me, one of the things, the really beautiful things right now about Reiki in general, is that there are so many different mini cultures within our Reiki community, and that richness, just like the world culture, is very important.
Yes, yes. And I believe that is changing in Mexico too. And,
uh-huh.
and you know, at first, a few years back, I guess there were not very many Reiki masters of this lineage, and then they sort of had the country divided, you know, this is yours, this is mine, this is where you can teach, this
right.
is where I can teach. And that really created a very strange Reiki community in the sense that they were, as you say, these mini groups, but mm-hmm. they wouldn't talk with each other.
Right.
You know, they would only meet when, and usually they were traveling masters.
Right.
And now I can see that because it's matured and many of these masters initiated in Mexico have stayed in Mexico and have initiated their own students, we can have better conversations.
Right. Because it's a local community then.
Exactly. A local community. And because, you know, Mexico is not a country that is very, at least not, it is in the indigenous world. But not in the wider world in Mexico, community is not very favored. You know, there isn't really a spirit of community, culturally.
That's interesting.
Yes, yes, it's
but family is very important.
Very. Interesting, that's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
That's interesting. So family, but not necessarily community.
Not necessarily community. There's a certain rivalry, or there is still a certain, I imagine, immaturity in the way that the social structure works, where
uh-huh.
it's actually everyone for itself. Himself, yeah.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Well, fascinating. Fascinating. Well, one of the things, the other things that I noticed in my being with the El Paso students, most of whom are from Mexico, either this generation or just the last generation, is that they tend when we establish this master-student relationship, there's this wonderful feeling of how should I say this? It's a little bit like, I think what we touched on, like the person is more important than Reiki mm-hmm. sometimes. And what has been really great for me is that I've taught there for about 7 years now, I guess, or maybe eight, and now it's switching, that Reiki is the thing that is more important than the master.
Mm-hmm.
And this switch for me feels a little bit like what you were speaking about locally in your community, that Reiki has become more of the topic or the still point, and the master is a vehicle for that particular still point.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting. And I think that in the United States or in other cultures that people get that the master is sometimes the part that is, the word that came to me is illusionary, but that's not really the right word in some way.
Mm-hmm.
that the master is the one that's changeable and Reiki will always remain.
Yes.
And I think, I don't know if that's true for you in L.A., but it certainly seemed true for me in some of the other classes where I taught in different parts of the United States and Canada.
Yes, yes, yes. It's there's so much more, you know, that that is available.
Uh huh.
I think one of the very fascinating conversations is that all the different expressions of that are called Reiki, you know, that have so many different forms.
Uh-huh.
So there's also the possibility, for example, several of the people that I have initiated have investigated. You know, they've really had a possibility to have experiences and choose.
Uh-huh.
And I really think that's something important when you live in a culture that offers so much.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it is something also that I see is new, you know, rather than how I was when I was a student before I became a Reiki master. You know, that's the message that I received or that how I interpreted. It was like we were practicing and the teacher or the master was the most important. And I see now that there is greater flexibility.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And the pulse. So it's wonderful for me to have the gatherings and listen to what happened,
mm-hmm.
to what the experiences were,
mm-hmm.
to the various degrees of consciousness about healing and about energy and about
mm-hmm.
a spiritual practice.
Great.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Well, we're almost at the end of our time, Alima.
Mm.
Amazingly enough.
Yes,
and it's wonderful to have talked about this in such a way, because I feel that one of the things that has come out is just the movement of the whole Reiki community in general, and it being exemplified in the individual places and cultures of different teaching experiences. So
mm-hmm.
thank you very much for your noticing that and also for your ability to express it.
Oh, thank you, Phyllis. It's very rich,
mm-hmm.
very rich conversation. I'm very grateful.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much. Is there anything that you would like to say in closing?
Thank you. No, I'm fine. I'm good.
Okay. Well, listeners, we'll be back again next week with another master. This is Phyllis Furumoto with Reiki, Balancing Form and Essence.